Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Pete Musto, and Anna Mateo. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
China has often come under criticism from its neighbors and Western nations for being a major polluter of air and water. Now, China says it wants to cooperate with other nations in efforts to clean up the oceans and protect sea life. In a recent speech, Chinese President Xi Jinping called for speeding up innovation in ocean technologies and creating blue partnerships with other countries. Xi spoke on October 15th to the 2019 China Marine Economy Expo in the southern Chinese port city, Shenzhen. His comments were reported by the state-run China Daily news website. Xi suggested improvements in efforts to stop ocean pollution and protect animals that are affected by it. He also urged cooperation with other nations in resource development. Experts believe such offers would help China improve its image with other countries, especially some of its neighbors in Asia. The latest proposal for cooperation follows a series of attempts by China to reach out to other countries in Asia. Eduardo Araral is a professor at the National University of Singapore's Public Policy School. He told VOA he sees China's invitation as part of a larger campaign aimed at gaining more acceptance with its neighbors. China approaches things using all tools and all means possible, from hard power to soft power, to diplomacy, Araral said. He added that some Southeast Asian countries that have territorial disputes with China would likely welcome joint pollution control. The disputes are centered on the South China Sea. China claims most of the 3.5 million square kilometer sea as its territory. Brunei, Malaysia, Taiwan, Vietnam, and the Philippines also claim parts of the waterway. China has angered other claimants in recent years by creating small man-made islands in some disputed areas of the sea and building military equipment on some of the land. Araral said Xi's recent call fits in with China's past attempts to find new ways to cooperate with its neighbors. I think it should be welcomed because it recognizes that other countries in Southeast Asia bordering the South China Sea have legitimate interests in terms of the resources, he said. One of those resources is fishing. China has the world's largest distant water fishing operation, with 2,500 ships and boats, the activist group Global Fishing Watch estimates. Some Chinese fishing operations take place in exclusive economic areas of other countries where enforcement is not strong. Chinese fishing boats have turned up in waters claimed by Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines. Araral said he thinks new cooperation efforts between China and its neighbors could help stop overfishing. They also may lead to research on joint resource development. Some Southeast Asian nations will welcome China's invitation if they are not asked to give up their territorial claims in the South China Sea. He added, "I'm Brian Lin."
In some ways, higher education is a self-serving experience. People often seek a college education because they want to improve their lives, or they want to increase their chances at gaining well-paying, interesting, and meaningful employment. Even if a person wants to find cures for major diseases or solve homelessness, they must spend years gaining knowledge and training for themselves before they can help others. A person's college years are usually very busy. It may not seem like they have the time or the freedom to serve anyone but themselves. But Connie Snyder-Mick says they actually do. Mick is the academic director of the Center for Social Concerns at the University of Notre Dame in the state of Indiana. Centers like hers exist at many colleges and universities in the United States. Mick says the centers help students seeking an experience that may not be directly related to a student's academic progress, but that is still important: volunteering. Volunteering is not uncommon in higher education. Many campus groups organize volunteer events or fundraising efforts for different causes. Officials in charge of student housing often organize such events to help build a sense of community. Involvement in these kinds of activities is good for students, Mick told VOA. For example, the busy nature of college life can create a lot of stress for students. Doing something completely unrelated to a student's studies or other work can help calm them by putting their mind on other things. For a deeper, more meaningful addition to their college experience, Mick urges students to visit centers like the one she heads. She says these centers exist to create volunteer opportunities that are more complex and meaningful than just a day spent cleaning a local park, for example. College students often spend little time getting to know the local community just outside of their campus, Mick notes. Higher education is all about introducing students to new ideas, she says. And these communities may be full of cultures and people that are very different from what the students already know. Campus volunteering offices often partner with local organizers that serve the people of the nearby community. These partnerships help make sure the volunteer efforts are meeting the real needs of that community. Even for students with little interest in finding a connection with the local community, there is still value in what volunteer centers have to offer, Mick says. She notes some opportunities can push students to use what they are learning in the classroom out in the real world. And having that kind of experience can make a student appealing to employers in the years to come. Imagine teaching computer science at a center for people with disabilities, Mick said. To think about how to apply more directly what you're studying in the classroom in ways that sort of push you to think about it differently can really be a creative space. Volunteering does not necessarily mean finding extra time in the evenings or weekends, she says. More and more schools are asking professors to design courses that include volunteer work. The research shows that when a student goes and has an experience, the learning happens in the reflection, and reflection happens in coursework, Mick said. So, you're getting that academic credit, but you're also having an experience that's thoughtful, that gives you times to do research and to think deeply about that in a way that's connected to your academic interests. Campus volunteer centers can help students identify classes that offer these kinds of experiences. The centers also can let students know if their school offers any volunteering-based trips during breaks between study terms. Mick says such trips can be a meaningful way to spend free time and explore other places. I'm Pete Musto.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. On this show, we take a closer look at words and expressions in the English language. We explain where they come from and how and when to use them. There are many times in life when we have disagreements or problems with other people. Maybe someone does something or says something that upsets us. But it is best not to let these issues fester. When a cut or wound festers, it becomes infected and painful. And fester is also used to describe a problem that gets worse. If you do not care for that medical image, you can also use the verb stew. When we stew over something, we think about it so much that it becomes a big problem for us. When we stew over something, we are upset or worried about it. We do not talk about the problem bothering us. We stew over it until it becomes much bigger in our own minds. If you stew over an unresolved problem or let it fester, it can become a big issue. You might call it a bone of contention. This phrase comes from the 16th century. Imagine, if you will, two dogs fighting over a bone. The bone is the contentious issue that two people fight over. Contentious describes something that is likely to cause people to argue or disagree. For example, the world of politics has far too many contentious issues to name. If I tried, we would be here all day. Okay, so unresolved issues often only get worse. Talking about them can help. But how do you raise the issue? Well, you could say to the person, "I have something upsetting to discuss with you, and it is something that you did, and I need to resolve it." But that is quite long. Thankfully, we do have an expression that means the same thing, but has fewer words and is more interesting. Instead, you can simply say, "I have a bone to pick with you." As with bone of contention, this phrase also comes from dogs during the 16th century. This time, the dogs are struggling to pick the meat off of a bone. If you use this expression, the other person will understand that A, you have a problem on your mind that you want to talk about, and B, they did something to cause that problem. We use this expression with our friends and family. It is a little informal, but we can also use it at work. Now let's hear two friends use these expressions.
So, is Steve coming to the party tonight?
Probably.
Good.
Why? And why do you have that look on your face?
What look?
Your angry look.
If you must know, I have a bone to pick with him.
Not again. What is it now?
Well, I'd rather talk to Steve about it first.
Look, you can take care of your bone of contention with Steve some other time. I don't want you two yelling at each other at my party.
What makes you think we're going to yell?
Because the last time you had a bone to pick with him, it ended in a yelling match.
Oh, right. Well, this time it won't come to that. I promise. We'll talk in the kitchen. It'll be more private.
No, not the kitchen. Take up your issue with him in the garage. It's more private, and there are fewer things for you to break.
Agreed. And that is the end of this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Last time, we talked about the Amistad case. The Amistad was a slave ship from Cuba. In 1839, it appeared off the eastern coast of the United States. The Africans on the ship had killed white crew members, including the captain. They demanded to go back home to Africa. But the two remaining slave traders on the ship secretly sailed the Amistad toward the United States. The U.S. government put the Africans in a low-security prison in New Haven, Connecticut, and it made plans to take the Africans to court. A judge would decide whether the occupants of the ship were slaves who had rebelled, murderers, or captives who had been kidnapped from their homes. The Amistad case brought attention once again to the issue of slavery in the United States. At the time, slavery was legal and an important part of the country's economy. But the U.S. and several European countries had banned the international slave trade. A small group of activists wanted to totally end slavery. They believed slavery was a sin. But in the 1830s, most Americans did not support these anti-slavery activists, known as abolitionists.
Most Americans, first of all, were racist, and secondly, saw these people as utter fanatics who were intent on destroying the Union.
Julie Roy Jeffrey is a professor of history at Goucher College in Maryland. She says newspapers reported on the Amistad case, and people began talking about slavery and the slave trade. Slowly, some Americans' feelings toward the abolitionist movement and enslaved Africans changed.
For example, there was a play put on in New York City called The Black Schooner that was based on the Amistad incident. And there were many, many people who went to see it. It became a popular event. And wax figures of the captives were exhibited in various places in the United States, and artists drew pictures of them.
The abolitionists wanted to make more Americans sympathetic to the Amistad Africans. They found lawyers to represent them, paid tutors to teach them, and organized outdoor exercises to keep them healthy and visible. Howard Jones taught history at the University of Virginia. He says one of the most popular members of the Amistad Africans was an 8-year-old boy who had learned English. The boy told the public about his life in Africa and about the conditions on the slave ship that brought him across the Atlantic Ocean. The Amistad case also was increasingly becoming a political issue. People wanted to know what President Martin Van Buren was going to do about the case. Historian Howard Jones says Van Buren found the position difficult. He did not want to anger Southern voters who supported slavery and wanted to make the African slave trade legal again. He also did not want to anger Northern voters who believed the Amistad Africans had been mistreated.
Van Buren did what any good politician would do, and that was to try to dodge the issue, stay away from it. He couldn't understand why 40-plus, by this time, black people should affect anything happening in high political society.
But the Amistad issue would not go away. The case began in a circuit court. After 3 days, it went to a district court. The district court judge ruled that the African slave trade was illegal under international treaties. For that reason, the Africans were wrongly taken. President Van Buren was worried the decision would cause more political problems for him, so he ordered the nation's highest court, the Supreme Court, to hear the case. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court at that time was Joseph Story. Story did not like slavery, but he did not support the abolitionist movement either. He thought its ideas opposed the rule of law. The abolitionists had good lawyers, but they knew they needed more help arguing their case in the Supreme Court. So they turned to former President John Quincy Adams. At the time, Adams was a congressman, not an abolitionist. But he led a campaign against an 1836 rule restricting anti-slavery petitions. Adams said the rule was a violation of the constitutional right to petition Congress. Historian Julie Jeffrey says the 1836 gag rule, as it was called, helped the abolitionists' cause.
It became partly a freedom of speech issue, not just about slavery, but about the rights of citizens to speak out and to be heard by their representatives in Congress.
Yet John Quincy Adams was not excited about arguing the Amistad case. He was 72 years old, nearly blind, and very busy. But the issue of the Amistad Africans troubled him. Howard Jones says Adams believed capturing people and enslaving them was immoral, especially in a country like the United States. In the end, Adams agreed to defend the Africans.
And he makes the argument in the court case that we have the Declaration of Independence right there on that wall, and that says that life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, it doesn't say for white people only or anything like it. He was trying to argue that it's something that's available for everyone. It's part of the justice system.
Chief Justice Joseph Story did not totally accept Adams' argument or suggest that any kind of slavery was wrong, but he did agree with the district court that these Africans had been taken illegally from their homes. They were not and had never been slaves, Justice Story said. They were free people and should be returned home. So in 1841, the remaining 30 or so members of the Amistad captives got on a ship called the Gentleman and returned to West Africa. Howard Jones says the incident was the only time he knows that black people who had been brought to the New World as slaves actually made it back home.
And how they do it? By winning in the American court system. This was just unheard of. But the decision was basically that it doesn't matter whether you are black, white, purple, green, or whatever color you are, you have been kidnapped. And so therefore you have, and Joseph Story said this in his decision, which really opened the door for a lot of arguments, that under the eternal principles of justice, you have the inherent right of self-defense, even if you must kill your captors.
Howard Jones says the Supreme Court decision also gave the abolitionists a new sense of power.
And the abolitionists immediately printed pamphlets, leaflets, had talks, everything they could to show that these people went free. And their implication was, this is what's going to happen to slavery itself, that this is a great victory for the black man.
But the Amistad case did not really change the situation in the United States for most black people. Many were the children of slaves and could not argue that they had been kidnapped from Africa. And it was still legal to trade slaves across U.S. state borders. The Amistad case also did not solve all the problems in the abolitionist movement. Julie Roy Jeffries says during the trials, many abolitionists worked together, including blacks and whites.
It sometimes worked very well, and it sometimes didn't work so well, but it was certainly one of the first times that blacks and whites had worked so fruitfully together.
After the Amistad victory, though, the abolitionist movement broke into different groups. Ms. Jeffries says some black abolitionists wanted more respect from white activists. Other abolitionists just had different ideas about how best to end slavery, by trying to change the country's laws or by appealing to Americans' moral sense of right and wrong. Abolitionism did influence other movements, however. One was the missionary movement. Julie Roy Jeffrey says Christian missionaries had already been going to Africa, hoping to persuade people to follow their religion. But the Amistad case and abolitionism made more people want to share their beliefs with others. Some missionaries even converted the Amistad captives to Christianity and returned to West Africa with them. Ms. Jeffries says the abolitionist movement also helped create the women's movement in the middle of the 1800s. She says most 19th century white women mainly cared for their families in the home, but women abolitionists played an important public role.
They weighed in on the most political question of the day. They took on activities like collecting petition signatures and raising money and giving speeches.
As a result, Ms. Jeffries says, some women came to believe they had a right to develop their own beliefs and have political power.
Sometimes they propped up their activism by appealing to things like the Bible. One woman I remember said something like, I read my Bible and I know what it tells me. And she was opposing the minister in her church, and she was a very active abolitionist.
Yet, even if abolitionism still did not personally affect most Americans, it made an increasing number of people question whether they wanted slavery to continue. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.